take a deep breath, prepare for the worst, the ugliest man in the universe.
Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Robert Johnson, and as always, I'm here with Judas Iscariot's bum boy, Christopher Webb.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
That was good, I enjoyed that one.
I'm very well. It's winter approaching and I'm in the garage, so I'm quite chilly.
Oh.
It's been such a long time since we've recorded one. I think it was summer last time.
It may have been, yeah.
In our defense, I had a little holiday and Rob moved house.
That's true. I bought a house. We had some changes.
So we had a little bit of time to adjust to that, but now we're back.
We're bad. He's black, I'm mad.
Nice.
Well, it's, when you look back on that piece of dialogue with Mel Gibson saying it, doesn't yeah. seem quite so innocent, does it?
Could be his autobiography title, couldn't it, really?
If I cast my mind back a month ago...
when we were watching Class.
When we were watching Class. It was your turn?
Yes, it was my turn to choose. So...
Remind me.
I think I'm going to have to remind everybody. Mm. I have to remind both of our listeners.
Yeah.
I've taken it back to 1989.
Ooh.
To the screenplay debut of one of Britain and technically New Zealand's best loved writers, Richard Curtis, because he was born in Wellington.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that little factoid.
So this is our Kiwi connection.
Yep.
So I've gone for The Tall Guy.
Jeff Goldblum is The Tall Guy. Dexter King has a few problems. His career is on the skids.
If you ever do anything funny in my show again, you elongated droplet of dung, you're out.
His roommate's a nymphomaniac. His love life is a mess.
Oh!
And he's scared to death of needles.
They say the real experts do it without even looking.
Then... Dexter meets Kate.
Well, the thing is, I'm not the sort of girl who believes in that. I think it's much better to go to bed with the person on the first date to get it out of the way.
Ooh, The Tall Guy. Interesting choice.
It was sort of towards the end of the summer of 1989. I'd just left school, and this may have even been the night before I left home to go away to college.
Ooh, yeah, you would remember that.
I'd had lots of drinks.
Yeah.
And I was sat there with my bezzy mate. Luckily, he was going to the same college as me.
Mm-hmm.
My brother and some of his mates. And we sat around watching this on video and enjoyed it very, very much. I think we may have just rewatched it over again in our drunken state.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
Yeah. And I've seen it a few times since then.
Okay.
But probably not for about 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So bearing in mind Richard Curtis's output since then, I was really interested, first of all, to see how it's stacked up mm-hmm. against those. Mm-hmm. And also, if you can compare it to them, because obviously Richard Curtis has quite a few trademarks.
His tropes.
And I was wondering if any of these were in there, almost like a little bingo card, like Curtis Bingo.
I dare say you would have filled that card quite substantially, actually, watching this.
Well, I've noted a few, yeah. So yeah. We'll play bingo as we go along, maybe. So what about you? Do you remember this one?
Yeah, I remember this well. This was on a couple of times on the telly when I was... young, so I probably haven't seen it for over 20 years either, but it was on TV a couple of times, and I think they put it on because, you know, sometimes the TV will put on a movie that is speaking to something that's happening at the time, so
yes.
This I think they might have put it on when Emma Thompson's career was really taking off in the early 90s, sort of like Oscar Oscar winning stuff, and or maybe even when, like, you know, Jurassic Park came out or something. And
it was when Jeff Goldblum brought out another jazz album.
Yeah, there's a bit of Goldblum in the air.
Because he's very much loved these days, isn't he, Jeff Goldblum? He's that new kind of actor that everybody loves.
He's sort of the... Well, he's had the kind of Bill Murray treatment a little bit, hasn't he?
That's a good comparison.
Well, didn't Wes Anderson sort of wheeled him out a couple of times, hasn't he?
Yeah, he was in... That one about the hotel whose title I can never remember.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say Hotel New Hampshire, but it's not that.
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yep. Is he in The Life Aquatic?
Yeah, he's in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
There's almost been like a Goldblum Renaissance. I can't put those two words together to make a portmanteau.
A Goldblum Renaissance. Yeah. And
because he is so loved now, isn't he?
He's royalty. He's one of those actors, I think, that he was always a little bit difficult to cast because, you know, he's a tall, gangly, kind of goofy guy, but with almost like a sub Christopher Walken cadence to his delivery that kind of...
He does this amazing thing with his hands.
Yeah, and it's
like a bony finger thing.
And he does that thing where he kind of like stops to smell a fart every few lines.
But he like kind of wafts it with his fingers as well. It's like he's doing sort of invisible glove puppets or something.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
He's got comic timing, but he also, I think there was a period of time, and I'm not sure if it's for all of his movies, but there's a period of time where you could just tell he loved himself. And thought he was just, like in Jurassic Park, you can just tell he sort of loves himself, thinks he's awesome. And yeah,
and I think that probably knocked on to Independence Day as well.
Independence Day, and he's kind of like, yeah, I'm the geek, but I'm like the hot geek who likes to take my shirt off and show you my ripped but incredibly gangly form.
Because, of course, I think his film debut was as one of the attackers in Death Wish.
Ah, okay.
You know the opening of the movie where Charles Bronson's wife and daughter get brutalized?
Yeah, yeah.
He's one of those attackers. He shows his bare bottom on screen.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
What an ignominious debut.
Got to start somewhere.
You have.
Drop your trousers, Jeff, says Michael Winner.
And this would have been, so in his career, this would have been a few years or a couple of years after The Fly.
Yes, that's right. The Fly was, I think, 85 or 86, something like that.
Had he really done a lot, really, since then?
I don't know. Yeah. He was in the remake of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I know that much.
Oh, that was late 70s, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about 1978, yeah.
So this was, I guess kind of a post-Fly, pre-Jurassic Park wilderness period. Yeah, and Emma Thompson, of course, before she got absolutely huge... Not physically.
Yes.
She's still quite svelte, from what I can tell. But
she is quite small. Yeah, I think this was one of her first film performances. Yeah. She is amazing. She's just fantastic. Yeah. She's every field that she's gone into, she has skyrocketed.
She's my favourite part of this movie, actually. She's just really, really immediately charming. Yeah. And of course, you've got some pretty interesting other people orbiting. Rowan Atkinson sort of playing himself.
Yeah, no, that is the thing, because when Rowan Atkinson started doing his one-man show when he was in Oxford, it was co-written by Richard Curtis, and the straight man was Richard Curtis.
Yeah.
So he knows this very, very well. When Rowan Atkinson got bigger, the straight man was Angus Deaton.
Yeah.
Who was also in this movie.
Yeah, and I loved, when I was a child, they played a performance of his, you know, his comedy, his one-man show with, and Angus Deaton was the straight guy, and it was just...
The Mr. Perkins,
It was the funniest thing I'd seen as a child. I loved it. And it was then Mr. Bean was on about a year later, and I was just like, what have you done?
I don't really like Mr. Bean. So to put it in perspective, this film came out in 1989, which was also the year of Blackadder Goes Forth.
Ah, yeah.
So it's kind of the last time that Rowan Atkinson...
Was good?
...did anything any good. Yeah.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
What happened?
I've read, there's quite an interesting book called The Blackadder Chronicles, and all of the options for subsequent series that were never made.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting one that we're going to do called The Blackadder Five, which was set in the 1960s, almost like a Beatles-type supergroup.
Oh, great. That would have been awesome.
Where he was the Brian Epstein and Baldrick was the drummer and all this sort of stuff. So that was mooted.
Tim McKinney would have been George Harrison.
Yeah, it was Tim McKinney and Fryan Laurie were the other two.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That would have been brilliant.
And there were loads. So the only other time he did Blackadder, other than It's a Royal Knockout, was that Millennium one they did at the Millennium Dome.
Back and Forth.
Which isn't very good. Yeah, Back and Forth, which isn't very good.
Yeah, bad. Is that when he's Ebenezer Blackadder as well?
Ebenezer Blackadder is the Christmas Carol, which is very good.
Yeah.
It's the one where he travels back in time to visit places like Robin Hood and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. And it's got a stellar cast, but it's not particularly funny. Mainly because it's shot on location. It's not done in a studio, so you don't have the audience.
And
is one of the reasons.
And so his character, Rowan Atkinson, plays Ron Anderson, and he's an absolute prick.
Yeah, and that's what I've written. Anderson's a prick.
Is Rowan Atkinson a prick?
I know. I think he has his moments of being a bit prickish. Mm. You know, driving like an arsehole on the roads. Yeah. He's recently come out in support of some quite dodgy comments that Boris Johnson's made,
God.
And things like that. So
yeah.
I think he has his arsehole-ish moments. But he certainly does in this.
And the casting of Jeff Goldblum is quite interesting, because as I was watching this, I kept thinking, what if Hugh Grant was the guy?
Well, yeah. It sort of flips the Curtis formula a little bit, because obviously in pretty much every subsequent British film, you've got posh English man with a floppy fringe falls in love with an American woman.
Yeah.
This is the American with a floppy fringe falling in love with a slightly posh woman.
Yeah. So Jeff Goldblum plays Dexter King, the straight man to the thinly veiled Rowan Atkinson, Ron Anderson. We see him being sort of humiliated and hit and kicked and punched by Rowan Atkinson and on their nightly performances. And
it's quite a nice way to set up
yeah.
that his life's a bit shit, really. And
yeah.
it's not just Ron Anderson, it's life that's kicking him in the bollocks, yeah. basically.
He does have quite a delightful woolen vest,
though. Oh, his tank top, which he wears with those khaki shorts, yeah.
But just in keeping with my, you know, I do like to highlight the...
Rob's knitwear.
I do like to highlight the knitwear.
I think we should have little jingles for all of these things. Listeners, if you want us to do jingles for Rob's knitwear, we would love to hear them.
Well, he almost looked like Doctor Who in a few scenes.
Yeah. It's almost like someone who's gone on a safari holiday by mistake, isn't it?
Yeah, he's got a shit life. And then it really hits home that he's got a bit of a shit life because, and I feel this is we're coming into one of our Richard Curtis tropes here, where he goes home to his quirky flat.
Enormous townhouse in Camden, which is a bit scruffy, therefore poverty.
It's a bit scruffy. There's quirky characters walking around, like, who walk in sort of to the kitchen. Oh, is there water here? I'll try the tap. And
there's a lot of men's arses, going on and stuff like that.
And Geraldine James.
She's great.
She's really good. She's a Curtis trope, though, isn't she? Because she's sort of the quirky...
She's the quirky confidant.
Quirky confidant flatmate.
Yep. There's also, we meet very, very briefly, another Curtis trope, which is the disabled friend.
Ah, yeah.
He's friends with the blind man.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But, of course, we haven't mentioned that Dexter has lots of allergies, too. He's allergic to pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Which is the inciting incident. That's what gets the ball rolling.
Yes, of course, he sneezes in the middle of one of their bits on stage, and Ron Anderson, very disappointed, says that you're performing like five kinds of shit tonight.
There are some good put-downs in this, actually.
And those are the Richard Curtis kind of... There are moments where that's a good Richard Curtis line.
Very much like your introduction of me.
Yeah. Judas Iscariot.
That's a very, very good one.
Yeah.
But with all of his sneezing and the naked man, it did make me laugh out loud when Dexter sneezed on a naked man's knob.
Yeah, that was.
I thought that was hilarious.
The thing that struck me by this scene, which I think is only like scene two, is how... how low budget. It just looked almost like a stage play.
Yeah.
I can't even really articulate what about it.
It did look very, very stagey. That's partly because of Mel Smith's direction.
Yeah.
I don't think he directed a feature before. He'd done some theatre, but he'd never directed a feature before. So that's possibly something to do with it. But you're right, I'd imagine, even though it was a very, very early working title film, probably very, very low budget.
Even just the cuts and the editing, it's just something, I don't know if they just hold on for a frame too long on some things or something, but it was just, yeah, of course, Mel Smith in the director's chair.
Who then did direct a couple of others. I know he worked with George Lucas on his next film, which was the Radioland Murders.
Oh, okay.
He directed one of the first Bean film.
Oh, did he direct Morons from Outer Space? Did he direct that? Or was he just in there?
I don't think he directed that, which is something I haven't seen for such a long time. But he did also direct quite a good, it's like a sort of a heist movie, like a female-led heist movie. I can't remember what it's called. But then we see a bit more of Dexter sneezing. He's trying to put on a product placement album. He's putting on the Madness album 7.
Yeah.
And he sneezes so much he sneezes on it and smashes the record player once he does a bit of sneezy dancing around the room.
Mm-hmm.
So he decides the best thing to do is to get some hay fever injections, get some shots. But of course he doesn't like shots, so he thinks he'll just have a course of tablets.
Mm-hmm.
But then he meets the pretty nurse.
Yeah.
Kate Lemon, played by Emma Thompson.
Fantastic name as well.
It is a good name, yeah.
Yeah.
He sees her being a little bit quirky, pretending to be a train with an elderly patient. And the other Richard Curtis trope, he's thunderstruck.
Yeah, yeah.
He immediately falls in love.
Yeah.
And just to labour the point, we flash back to him being smacked on the head by Rowan Atkinson. So it's like a smack in the head.
There's a lot of cutaways in this. Almost like a Family Guy episode. There's just like cutaway gag, cutaway gag, cutaway. And
it feels like Richard Curtis has written this like he's never going to write another film again.
Yeah.
He's thrown everything into
it.
Sometimes it feels a bit sitcom. Sometimes it even feels like The Young Ones.
Yeah. It does feel sitcom-y a lot of the time.
Yeah, and because of that, it's very different from his subsequent films, where obviously he's got a bit more confidence, got a bit more money, and he knows what he wants is going to get made.
Yeah. But yes, Kate Lemon is quite charming, quite believable. I just think Emma Thompson just, you know, she probably could do this part with her eyes closed, her hands tied behind her back, which yep. kind of happens in a later scene. but she's probably the only yep. only character that kind of feels like she could be a real person in real life.
Yeah. She's a fully fleshed out, and I don't mean that in sense of the scene that's coming up later. She's a fully fleshed out character.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could easily see Jeff Goldblum's character would fall in love with her.
Yeah.
Because she's just lovely.
Not so much the other way around, though. But...
Oh, no, he's a tit. He's a lovable tit.
Well, he's a tit.
Yeah.
Still not talking about the scene that comes up, though.
No. Can we take a moment to talk about Dr. Karavecki?
Doctor, oh, God. Okay, if we must.
Sorry, I thought he was really funny. So when Dexter goes in to see the doctor about his allergies, there is another doctor on the desk called Dr. Karavecki, and who's this crazy beardy man with mad hair who just goes a lot. And you obviously weren't a fan, but I thought he was hilarious.
Yeah, I was, and this is almost like a British sketch show character or something that's just kind of wandered in. Yeah, yeah. And then he takes over the inoculation, doesn't he?
Which really, really made me laugh. Especially when he says, they say some people do it without looking, and he sort of makes a huge effort to turn the other way and smile at the same time. I thought it was really funny.
I'm glad you did. I'm glad.
But I can see where you're coming from in that. So a lot of these characters don't sort of fit together.
Yeah,
they're like from different writers' voices.
Yeah, and some very broad characters, some more sort of muted, believable, naturalistic characters. But yeah, and he was a very broad comic character.
For the benefit of our listeners, Dexter has decided to have the injections because he thinks that Kate is going to give him the injections, and that will give him a chance to ask her out.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, she's called away, and Dr. Karavecian gives her the injections. So he decides that the best thing to do, another Richard Curtis ding, is to lie.
Yeah, yeah.
In order to get into her pants. Mm-hmm. And he does that by saying that he's going to Morocco, and so he needs a lot of inoculations and vaccinations, which she will, of course, deliver.
Yeah.
There is quite a nice cutaway then. It is one of those cutaways, just a little interesting fact, where they're saying, where he has a cutaway and it's surgery, and they're saying this man has no spine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
The surgeon says that. Yep, yeah. Jason Isaacs.
I knew Jason Isaacs was in it, and I couldn't.
Yep, he's one of those surgeons.
Pick up where he was. I got to the end of the movie, and I was like, I didn't see Isaacs.
So hello to Jason Isaacs.
Hello, Jason.
There should be a podcast where they say that. But he still doesn't ask her.
Yeah, I kind of lost sympathy with him about this point as a character because I just thought, for fuck's sakes, he's like 39 years old or something. Like, it's not like he's a 17-year-old, you know, this is his first kind of thing. It's actually not endearing when you're kind of encroaching on middle age and doing this kind of stuff.
He does very often write women as something to be afraid of. You can't go near them. You can't talk to them properly.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in things like Love Actually or any of those. Women are kind of unattainable.
Yeah.
So you have to pretend to be something else in order to talk to them, for Christ's
sake. Or if Andrew Lincoln just hold up cards with words on them.
Yeah, or even that nipper in it who learns to play the drums. He only pretends to be a drummer so he can get off with the cute girl. Just talk to her.
Yeah, well, Liam Neeson approved.
Well, yeah. He thinks all is lost, so he goes back to one of his old girlfriends, an amusing Eastern European lady, who calls him Mr. Petrol.
Pump me, Mr. Petrol.
But when he's in the restaurant in the whole of London, he still bumps into Kate in the restaurant.
Yeah, that was awkward.
But then, of course, he realises he has one last chance. So as he's walking through what looks like Clapham Common, which is a very dangerous area, he just leaves that poor lady by herself and buggers off back to the hospital to finally ask Kate for a date. And even then he chickens out and has to lie to her once more. He claims that he's thinking about becoming a nurse, so he wants to talk about it over dinner. And it's only when she says, no, sod off, that he says, yes, I do think you're pretty, I do think you're nice, I'd like to go out to dinner with you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And of course she says, you know.
Takes us half an hour to get to that point. At this point, what are you thinking the film's about? The tall guy. It's just about a tall guy.
Yeah, it's about a tall guy who's crap. It should be called the crap guy.
The crap but tall guy.
We've already decided that he's crap in his job. Yeah. He's I mean, he's not crap because he's got allergies, but obviously we're meant to look down our nose at him because, oh, he can't even sit near a pillow without sneezing or whatever.
You can't even walk past them naked without him sneezing on your cock.
That's right, yeah. He's obviously crap with women because he can't talk to them, even though in his flashbacks he's having athletic sex with various women.
Yeah.
It still means he's having a shit time. But yeah, it's about someone who's rubbish.
Interesting watching this going, okay, so is this about a romance? Is that what it's about? Because for half an hour that's been the only thing driving some kind of plot, really, is, you know, we've established he's crap, and then the plot has been him trying to woo Nurse Kate.
Yeah, so, but he doesn't learn that not telling the truth won't get you anywhere. Yeah. We learn that later.
Yeah.
That being deceptive still doesn't get you what you want.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel romantic. And it's just a series of jokes.
And structurally, the film is a bit wonky as well. But
it's very uneven, yeah. You're absolutely right. It's half an hour to get to the first date, if you like.
Yeah. But what a date.
Oh, I'll say, yeah. So she's tired. She's supposed to go out for dinner, but she basically says, oh, I'm a bit tired. Let's not go out. Tell you what, let's just have some sex.
Yeah.
And he says, for once, he goes, yeah, all right then.
And has Ron Anderson fired him at this point?
Not yet. He fires him after what happens next.
Okay.
He's giving him another bollocking.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, of course, he's got a date with Kate, and so he fucks up the dancing nun routine.
That's right.
Which wasn't funny to begin with.
No.
But he has a bit of a dance, and so he tells him off for that, and he says, if you do anything like that again, you're sacked. F-U-C-K-E-D, sacked.
Yeah.
So he goes around to Kate's the next day. It is the best sex scene ever. It's really brilliant.
It's an iconic sex scene, really, isn't it?
I think it's funny. I think it's sexy.
All right, enough of that.
It's not particularly realistic. It's probably more realistic than Body Double. If there's some more of this in Body Double, I'd have enjoyed it.
There's no Pino Donaggio synthesizer score, though, in the background.
No. Because there's bare arses going on bits of toast and milk cartons and stuff like that. I thought it was very, very funny. I really enjoyed this scene.
I forgot how over the top it was. Like, I knew it was very over the top. The fact that they literally roll all over the floor, up a wall, out of a wardrobe. Then she kind of just sort of hooks her hand into a coffee cup or a pot or something and smashes it on his head.
There's a bit where there's an arse on the piano and his head's on the piano or something like that. I just thought it was really funny.
I remember, you know how everyone has those tales of they put on a movie by themselves in the lounge and then just as the sex scene comes on, you know, your mum or your dad walks in with a cup of tea and sits down and just oh, what are you watching? and then you have to sit there. And whether it's a 20-second sex scene or a 2-minute sex scene, it just feels like an hour and you're just sitting there.
My parents walked on me watching the beach party scene in Police Academy. So, yes, I feel your pain.
But I actually remember with this one, I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. Because there's quite a lot of Emma Thompson nudity in it. But then I also just remember laughing because it is just so comedic and silly
it's
and fun.
Utterly ridiculous, yeah.
So, very well-deserved status as the best sex scene ever.
I think so. Mm. But because of the best sex scene ever, Dexter's missed his show. And the stagehand, Cypress Charlie, has to take over.
Yeah.
And they do that Mr. Bean, Blind Man on the Beach skit. Yeah. And Charlie ends up by falling off the stage, which I thought was really funny.
Yeah.
But it does end with both of them being fired. So that's it. Dexter's out of a job. And then we get a falling in love montage.
Yeah.
Which is, again, we're talking about best evers. Probably one of the best covers ever, which is Madness's It Must Be Love plays in the background.
That's the other thing that your casual viewer of this film, there are two things that you just associate with this film. That sex scene and Suggs singing.
Yeah.
And the number of TV commercials that have fucking use that since.
But it's a very strange montage because it does go a little bit Young Onesie.
Yeah.
With his sort of singing glove puppet underpants and people singing direct to camera and things like that. It's unusual.
The characters don't. It's kind of dated, isn't it? Do you think it's just kind of an 80s British comedy? Let's try everything that we've done in British comedy in the last 10 years on TV and in movies and just slap it on the screen.
They don't do this much in films. Let's be quirky.
Yeah. We haven't really mentioned it, but Geraldine James is kind of quirky but sage-like flatmate. She's a bit of a enthusiast in the sexual area herself.
She is, very much so, yes.
There's a range of gentlemen callers.
Several men wandering around her house. Yeah. One I note, which is again Curtis Bingo, there's one called Bernard.
Ah.
Now, if you go through anything from Richard Curtis, there's always somebody called Bernard in it. I think it started with Blackadder 2, where Nursey reveals her first name is Bernard.
Bernard. Yeah.
Bernard. From there on, there is somebody called Bernard in, I think, everything he's written.
Okay.
Even in the more serious stuff like Love Actually, Emma Thompson and Alan Rickman, one of their children is called Bernie.
Ah, wow.
But it follows. And once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. There's always someone called Bernard.
About Time, even About Time? Bernard?
Yeah, the crazy, slightly forgetful uncle is Uncle Bernard.
Ah, fantastic. You know your Curtis.
I know my Curtis. I could go on Mastermind, and my specialist subject would be Richard Curtis.
Oh, wow.
It wouldn't really. So, yes, they're in love.
Yeah.
And through that, she's tried on his fantastic pajamas, his Superman pajamas, which I like very much.
Yeah.
But, of course, Dexter's now out of a job, so he goes to see his agent, Anna Massey.
I actually found this quite a funny scene, actually.
I like this very much. So we've got in the waiting room, we've got Angus Deaton,
yep.
and also the actor Robin Driscoll, and they're being given some amazing roles. Here's the Scorsese, here's the Tom Stoppard, yeah. which is very, very good.
Yeah, we're not sure if you should be reading the Pinter or the Stoppard.
Yeah. It's excellent. But, of course, they just give Dexter a one pager where he's going to play the tall American in a shaken vac ad. He'd probably get paid more for that than appearing in a Stoppard play.
I really cracked up when she said, and shaken vac.
Shaken vac. But then he goes to a Burkoff audition, which again I thought was really funny.
That was good.
They're just shouting, fuck off. You fuck off. And he just goes, no, you fuck off.
They thought he lacked anger.
He got pretty pissed off by the end. But the edited for TV version, which you may or may not have seen, they replaced it with sod off. So they're all just going, sod off, sod off, you sod off. Which really kind of lacks the punch of it, really.
It does.
Which makes it just even funnier. He then gets a break because he is auditioned for a new musical based on the Elephant Man called Elephant.
Yeah, yeah.
Now this bit, the whole Elephant Man bit, is fantastic.
It is quite good, yeah.
I think it's really good.
Yeah. One of the, I don't know if you call it a theme or a subplot or a motif, is just lovey culture, isn't it, of this movie?
Yeah, yeah.
It's love, and then it really sort of ramps up a bit with this Andrew Lloyd Webber piss take.
As far as the structure of the film goes, it's all over the place, but as a little standalone act, I think it's great.
Yeah, it is good.
The songs are brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because when the songs came, the one where they bring him out and it's prepare for the worst. I remembered that from when I was a kid because it was that kind of catchy. I totally remembered it. The ugliest man in the
universe. The one I always remember is where they're singing about London, City of Sin, just one great big loony bin. Is where they're talking about the fog and he goes, egads me lads, it's a real pea super.
And then there's direct kind of piss take of I Don't Know How to Love Him in Jesus Christ Superstar, which is I don't know how to...
As Long As He Needs Me. It's that sort of song, isn't it?
I don't know how to reach him. And then it's a little line about it.
He's so elusive, like a priest or a monk.
Before long, he's packing his trunk.
It's so good. I think it's so brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an inspired idea, isn't it? A musical based on The Elephant Man.
I'm surprised it hasn't been done.
It's something that these days, if you're kind of postmodern approach to musicals and things, it's something that would be done.
Well, there was an American Psycho musical a couple of years ago with Matt Smith in it, so nothing can be untouched, really.
And the makeup was quite good.
The word is, yeah. While they're doing the auditions, because Dexter is so unco, he gets the lead. He gets the role as John Merrick.
Yeah, and I actually love the scene where they're all singing around the piano and the director says, someone sounds a little bit flat. Can you give
and
me?
He's just got his finger in his ear, going
bah. Everyone's doing like a perfect pitch, perfect, and then yeah.
But then, of course, because he's now being successful, temptation finds its way into Dexter's life because playing the female lead is Cheryl Kim Thompson.
Yeah,
and she's naturally and understandably charmed by Dexter's floppy clumsiness.
Yeah.
She thinks he's great.
Yeah.
It's the Hugh Grant treatment all over again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hugh Grant would have been perfect in this role, except for not being particularly tall and American. But if it was, they could have just called it the floppy haired guy. But
the posh guy.
Yeah, yeah. The bumbling posh guy. I mean,
No. You, I think you'd rather find should fuck off.
He just would have been really good. I just.
And knowing what we know now about Hugh Grant, and I always talk about Paddington 2,
yeah.
But having seen the end credits of Paddington 2, have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't. No.
It's a musical number and he's amazing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. And so, yes, he would have been great.
Yeah. So Cheryl sets her sights on him.
We move then, after the rehearsals, we move to the opening night. We get a little cameo from Melvin Bragg.
Yeah, it's very good. Was it the first stage musical about Elephantiasis?
Elephantiasis.
There's a couple of little cameos like that, because Jonathan Ross is in it earlier on as well.
Jonathan Ross is in it, absolutely. Yeah. And John Inman as well, I noticed, turns up at some point.
John Inman at the awards, presenting the award.
Which is great, presenting like an Olivier Award. John Inman is brilliant. So we have opening night where everybody turns up. Probably goes on for way too long, but it is really funny. We see a few songs, including this ridiculous dance number, a tap number with people with elephants' heads on.
Yeah.
Which just goes on for ages. Reminded me a little bit of the Pink Elephants bit in Dumbo, which just goes on for too long. But it is still really, really funny. And then we get the after-show party. So Ron turns up, does a little bit of name-dropping about Charles and Di.
Yeah.
And also does a really backhanded compliment about Dexter. You know, the word on the street is your makeup is absolutely excellent.
Yeah.
It's a good line. So it's a big party scene.
Mm-hmm.
Gavin, the director, starts talking about his next idea, which is Dirty Dick.
Oh, musical about Richard III.
Which is brilliant. Yeah. I've got a hunch I'm going to be king.
That is so good, yeah.
And then Mel Smith has a little cameo. He turns up and falls over.
Yeah.
But of course, what we have missed is Cheryl at this point has... She hasn't seduced Dexter. I'm not going to say she seduced him, but she's taken him aside and...
Bonked him
at a rap party. And so Dexter now sort of has this on his conscience, but he doesn't really.
Not really.
He doesn't look guilty for a second. No. But Kate has realised that he's been having an affair with that Cheryl.
Through some quite impressive intuition and deduction.
Yep, that's right. So we have little flashbacks about how she's worked it out.
Yeah.
So she leaves him. Quite right too.
Yeah. And the movie kind of should have ended there. Should have just been a sort of a bittersweet, oh well, you sort of it's almost like the Rachel papers. You've got this girl that you love and then you cheated on her and then you fucked up and
you had everything. You had a girl that you love, you had a lead in a top show which could run for years and years and years, and you just screwed it all up. You just pissed it away.
But no, we've still got 12 minutes left in the film.
So we get some typical overdone scenes of loneliness where he's splashed with water, there's some lonely songs on the radio, and there's discussions about infidelity on TV.
Yeah.
What did make me laugh is they talk about infidelity and they say our special guest, Cecil Parkinson. And then we're backstage at Elephant, and the Olivier Awards are on TV.
Yeah, John Inman.
It's John Inman. Mm. And Ron wins an award for Best Comedy Performance.
Yeah.
And Kate is with him.
Yeah, he kisses her on the cheek.
Dexter is incensed by this, never mind the fact that he has had it off with somebody else. He is, of course, being a man.
Yeah.
Utterly outraged that somebody else could kiss her on the cheek after she's dumped him. How dare she?
You would be pissed off, though.
You would have, because it was him.
Yeah. You'd be. But it's kind of juvenile that's the impetus for him to go and claim her back.
It's not because he feels bad or he feels guilty. It's because someone else has got her.
Yeah.
So he does the final Curtis thing of the mercy dash for love. He goes to see Ron. He kidnaps him, if you like.
Ties him up. Yeah.
Steals his car keys. Ron does say, which again I think is a great line, he says, this sort of shit never happened to Charlie Chaplin. But he steals Ron's car, which is actually Rowan Atkinson's real car.
Oh, okay.
But the COM1C license plate belongs to Tarby.
Jimmy Tarbuck.
It's Jimmy Tarbuck's license plate.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah. So Tarby goes around the golf course with that license plate.
Brilliant.
He probably stops to pick up Kenny Lynch on the way, and they're off playing golf together in COM1C. Because he's gone on the mercy dash, he can't play John Merrick in the show. So good old Cypress Charlie to the rescue again. He puts on some makeup. He's brilliant as John Merrick. Really, really funny.
Yeah.
And he goes to see Kate. There's a lot going on. There's been a big RTA. So there's a lot of blood and a lot of death going around. But because he's in charge, he gets to stop her. She calls him adulterer, which I thought was good.
Doesn't really do that much of a impassioned plea to get her back, does
it? No. It's meant to be the endearing speech at the end of a Curtis film.
Yeah.
It's not really.
No. This is just a guy standing in front of a girl saying sorry for shagging that other girl.
I mean, he basically just says, I was a complete idiot.
Yeah.
And I'm a tall American who belongs nowhere except by your side.
Yeah.
Well, don't fuck somebody else then.
Yeah. Well, was this supposed to be his kind of, I feel like I don't belong anywhere, I'm...
It's a you complete me.
Yeah. I, you know, yeah, exactly. But it was just so under-delivered and kind of probably Goldblum's sleepy delivery doesn't help.
It was a flimsy please.
I'd be like, really? That's your attempt to woo me back? No.
And I think it lets down Emma Thompson's character as well, because she's been the only strong, intelligent, likeable one. A 30-second speech and she takes him back.
Yeah.
It sets a very bad precedent, because in about 30 years' time, she's just going to be alone crying and listening to a Joni Mitchell CD. When she thinks she's getting some nice jewellery. I'm convinced it's the same character,
after
I'm convinced.
Alan Rickman's fucked her over.
Yep,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Same. She's just going to be alone listening to that CD. But she takes him back. But it's in front of loads of people. It's like those when people propose on live TV.
Mm.
It's a trap.
Yeah.
Because if she says no, sod off, she turns out to be the baddie.
Yeah.
Because there are already some of the patients going, oh, go on, give him another chance.
Yeah.
Well, just stop it. It's not fair.
It's not cute. I didn't find this bit cute. But then,
no.
How the hell... So he's assaulted Ron Anderson. He's stolen his car. What are the consequences of that?
I thought this too. He takes her back. The next, you know, he's going to jail for wrongful imprisonment, vehicle theft and speeding.
Plus he's only done a Stephen Fry on his bloody job. And left poor Rick Mayall in the fucking lurch.
Yeah. So the hospital is his Brussels. It's true, there's no future in this relationship for that reason. He's going to jail.
Yeah.
Ron Atkinson's not going to let it... Ron Atkinson. Ron Anderson's not going to let it slide, is he?
He's made some really bad choices here.
Yeah. But that is how it ends. It ends with happiness. It ends with the arms swinging. It ends with madness singing It Must Be Love.
Yeah.
The end.
So, Chris, still any good?
Here's the thing. We've talked about it quite dismissively and quite badly.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that Jeff Goldblum's character is quite annoying, quite unlikable, and doesn't deserve what he gets, there were enough jokes in this to make me laugh and make me enjoy it.
That's good.
So I still thought it was quite good. Not as good as I remember.
Well, it's 30 years old.
But I could watch this over Love Actually.
Yeah.
Or what's that one on with the radio, The Boat That Raped?
Oh.
I could certainly watch this 100 times more than that one.
That was awful. I hated that one.
There's enough momentum in there just to make me laugh through it. There was plenty of gags and plenty of fun stuff, so I did actually still enjoy it.
I was a little conflicted because there were ideas and jokes in here that I did like, and some performances that I did like. You know, I thought Emma Thompson was great. I liked Rowan Atkinson. I liked the little cameos. But I found myself, my attention waning in spots, and kind of going, what is this about? It's about this guy, obviously, but...
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
What is it about this guy, you know? I really enjoyed the elephant musical thing. I thought was great. But I kind of didn't enjoy it. And there are things that have dated that just... stylistic kind of things that you can't really blame it as a 30-year-old movie.
Mm.
And as a curiosity and as a proto-Curtis adult rom-com, it's very, you know, it's interesting to kind of tick off those tropes and sort of see, God, yeah, this would be a, you know. So, I almost liked it, but I didn't quite like it.
I get that. I think it's very interesting in that, as an early Richard Curtis, his view of London in this is very, very different from the London of his future films, in that it's not an advert for London. It doesn't glamorise
it.
There's no double-decker buses. We're not going over Tower Bridge.
Yeah.
We're in Camden.
Yeah.
And he's going down back alleys talking to prostitutes and things like that. So it's quite a grubby, very 1980s side of London, which I thought was kind of interesting. But I think one of the big flaws about it is, in any film, you don't necessarily have to like the protagonist.
No.
But you have to care. I think he was just too pathetic.
Yeah.
Obviously, those faults were set up to be a sort of an everyman. Hey, we've all got faults, but we can still fall in love.
Mm.
But he's got nothing. He's gangly. He's stupid. He makes bad choices. It sounds awful, but he's got these annoying allergies.
So they point out, obviously, the fact that he's American. And so there should be some reason for that. But there's no reason for that other than they've cast Jeff Goldblum.
Well, it's green lights. That's the only reason he's American, is because they wanted an American for overseas sales. very same reason he has American women in his feature films. It's for an overseas market.
There's nothing about, you know, the way he has, you know, his values or his outlook on life that is like particularly American, that it's a culture clash kind of or whatever thing, you know, that would
have... That's a really good point. Yeah. There's none of that. So why is he American? Yeah. There's no need for it.
And that's why when I was watching it, I was just like, this should be Hugh Grant. This just should be Hugh Grant. It would have been much more endearing for me.
Or even someone not as physically attractive as Hugh Grant.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Let's say Tim McEnany or something like that. You know, he's tall.
Yeah.
He's bumbly. It's a possibility.
The McEnany man.
You know what I mean? If he was Hugh Grant at that age, was just drop dead gorgeous.
Yeah.
So someone who's not traditionally as handsome. I mean, Jeff Goldblum's a good fit for that, obviously.
Yeah.
But you're right, the Americanism is irrelevant.
And I didn't care about him. I sort of just thought he was a dick.
Yeah, I cared more about her.
I cared more about her, and I just didn't understand what the plot was. And it wasn't quite character-driven enough to have as little plot as it did.
Yeah,
As a series of kind of skits and jokes and things, I enjoyed those.
It's sort of Curtis finding his feet, I suppose, isn't it? You can still see the sitcom writer in there.
Yeah.
There's so many ideas being thrown around.
It's a very interesting one as part of his filmography to watch. But no, I'm sorry, Chris, I'm not going to give you the win on this one.
That's what it's about.
The tally.
I knew this would cause problems.
Because you thought it was good, and I sort of thought it was nearly good.
No.
It's
all or nothing, because I'm sure in future episodes we're going to have a similar argument. So, no, that's fair enough.
I'll let you have it. I don't want you to think I'm cynically trying to alter the...
It's still 10-7, that's okay. That's all right. So, what have we got next? It's your turn.
Well, I have taken us back to 1983 again. I think the same year as Class. What the hell was going on? I was only two at the time. So
you just plonked in front of the telly like a babysitter.
This film was one of the... You know, we always talk about the VCR tapes that you'd bust out on a rainy day. I love this. I must have watched this about, and no exaggeration, about 30 times when I was a kid. And it was one of those films that I always, when had friends staying the night, let's watch this. You know, have you ever heard of this? No. Okay, well, we're going to watch it. And then they'd be like, this isn't... this isn't my cup of tea. But
I'm really interested now.
They used to do that with Top Secret too, and I'd be like, fuck, you just don't get it. You're just cretins.
Well, your friends are fools.
They're cretins. But yeah, I used to love this. I thought it was just amazing. And it's when I start telling you some of the cast members, you're just going to blow your mind, okay?
Ooh, right.
John Cleese.
Okay.
Graham Chapman.
Well, all right. Okay, I see where we're going.
Eric Idle.
1983?
Yeah.
Is this The Meaning of Life?
No.
Oh, okay. Secret Policeman's Ball?
No. James Mason.
James Mason?
Yeah.
Okay.
David Bowie even shows up.
Oh, okay. I know where you're going. Okay.
Peter Cook,
yeah.
Pretty exciting comic cast, yeah?
It's pretty stellar, actually,
Stellar, yeah. Well, the film is the pirate comedy spoof Yellowbeard.
Yellowbeard?
Mm.
Well, for your 30 times, I'm a big fat zero.
Wow.
Never seen it. I mean, I've been aware of it, obviously, but never, ever seen it.
Never piqued your curiosity.
No, and I'm a big Python fan, so I will look forward to seeing it.
Oh, good. As will I.
Yeah, look forward to that.
Good.
And we must get back together very soon to talk about it.
Excellent. Oh, well.
That was short and sweet.
It was.
As opposed to Jeff Goldblum, who was tall and cretinous. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood. And if you wanted to email us, StillAnyGood@gmail.com.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, see you soon. Cheers.
Bye.
See you, folks. Bye-bye.
Shake and back and put the freshness back. When your carpet smells fresh, your room does too. Every time you vacuum, remember what to do. Do the shake and back and put the freshness back.
Shake and back, now in three fragrances.